Well, it is surely hard, or fate, to be preaching this sermon in the wake of losing one of my two beloved dogs. Joey, my big, strong younger dog, got out of the house and was struck by a hit-and-run driver. And his back was broken last Thursday night. Our family is still reeling, and will be for a while. Before I say anything else, let me say that I am so aware that many in this hall of our people have suffered far worse losses in the past year than this. If my own loss was even worse, no doubt I would not be able to mention it at all, and I would certainly not be up here before you now. Mine does not approach what some of us have suffered. But it is enough. Together with my involvement in two losses in this congregation so far this year, they have grown my sense of this community and our people here. So it certainly hits home to be in deep, immediate grief on this day when we honor our love and grief and respect for those we have lost from this church, from our families, and from our lives. With my own loss added, my reflections run strongly along the path of divining and evaluating what happens after death. For we who are the living and the left behind. Given this week has been what it's been, I want to lift up some of what I said at a memorial service that same day, last Thursday, for a daughter of this congregation. And some of what I often say at memorial services. The more we love, the more we fear, wrote the insightful 19th century American leader and thinker Robert Ingersoll. Upon the tenderest heart, the deepest shadow falls. His words are so true. The more we love, the more we fear. And the more we love, the more we weep. What I preached last Thursday, not knowing what would be coming my way later that day, was that ultimately we live in the face of death, and we love each other, though we know death parts us, will part us all. When you think about it that way, love is not just instinctual or joyous or one of the best things about being a creature with the capacity to love. Apart from all of that, love is courageous. It is more than just a risk, because even the best love, the most lasting love, will break our hearts in the end when we are bereft. And that is not a reason not to love. I am the last person ever to preach that. But it is a reason to honor the bravery of love. The connection of one person with another, one soul with another, the opening of one soul to another is as deep, as holy, as powerful as life gets. No wonder such capacities as sacrifice, justice, lifelong commitment, children, family come along with it. Nothing less would even make sense. But it is also true that while we are truly bereft when we lose one we love, and that it's one of the worst experiences in life, it's also true that having known and loved another means they hold a place in our memory, and not just in our memory, but in our living, because we are changed by those we love. We learn from them. We respond to them. We are different in small and large ways because of the experience of loving them and having them in our lives. They really do become part of us. We hand each other on in a chain of relationship and generations, not only genetically, but experientially, in ways that are utterly, utterly real. The American undertaker and poet Thomas Lynch says something about this. He writes, "There are distinctions to be made between notions of medical death or metabolic death, social death, spiritual death, and actual death as far as your family is concerned. I might know, for example, that after a cremation we end up with, say, 14 pounds of bone fragment and desiccated tissue that we can put in a box and hand to the family. But when you see the elderly sister come to claim the ashes of a sister whose own children couldn't come and get her, when she bears the box like a viaticum, when she walks out to the car and flips open the button to the trunk, and then reconsiders and goes to the back door of the car and opens it up, and then thinks better of it and closes it again. When she goes to the front seat passenger door and opens it up and places the box on the front seat and then clicks a seatbelt around it, you can see that whether we are remnant or icon or relic is not up to you or me. It's up to the living who bear us in their memory and in fact bear our mortality, because we are humans tied to the humus, this layer of earth from which our monuments and our homes and our histories rise up. Clinical and anecdotal analyses of mourning, everything from Freud to C.S. Lewis's self-reportage in A Grief Observed, tells us that grief sends us out of our ordinary living. Perhaps in keeping with the quickened pace of life in the last century, perhaps in keeping with America's focus on frontiers and the future, perhaps in keeping with our modern mania for youth and all that comes with it, like hope and renewal, we have increasingly begun to emphasize limits to grief and the grieving process. We assign artificial durations, 1 year, 5 years, so many years for this kind of loss, so many years for that kind of loss. We assign stages and seek to move dutifully through them as if they are stepping stones on a genteel garden path we can hardly miss, rather than the anguished casting about of psyches in a wilderness that is overwhelming and terrifying. The stories we moderns tell of epic love and loss, they come from Shakespeare or opera or Broadway. We don't expect them in our lives or in the lives of our neighbors. No one dies of a broken heart anymore, do they? Actually, they do. We do. We humans sicken and die, even die of grief, all the time. If we don't believe it from the timeless art that tells us so, then we can look to insurance statistics. They relate that family and close friends of someone who has died are at quite discernibly greater risk for accidents and illness, including death. We lose our jobs. We lose our relationships. We become estranged or self-destructive. All manner of things happen to us after losing someone we love. And what happens depends on lots of factors, including the nature of the loss and our family systems and our life experience and our class and our health insurance and much more. All that is true, and we don't really acknowledge it. Indeed, many of our most potent forms of Western grieving are ancient and not modern. Ancient is the tradition that everything stops to take care of the dead and the mourning. Modern is the custom that we get cremated to save space on the planet and also the need to deal with the body as a part of a mourning ceremony. And we often urge our loved ones to hold a memorial service at some later time that will be convenient for all. I once went to a traditional Jewish funeral for the relative of a close friend. And the funeral director came and pinned a ribbon to each of our tasteful dark outfits and then made a small tear in the ribbon. And I learned that the torn ribbon symbolizes rent clothing, the kind of rending of your clothing that goes along with tearing at your hair and collapsing and wailing in grief. That's biblical, right? That's biblical, or maybe Eastern or something else, but it's not us. It's not what we do. What if we witnessed someone doing something like that? Would we feel we were seeing someone expressing grief to the point of anguish? Or would we rather feel that such a display was a little over the top and they probably need care, maybe a doctor, maybe a sedative, maybe some kind of control? Don't we admire, even if we also worry for, people who go through terrible loss with their act together? Isn't that why every time I am working on a memorial service or funeral with a family, the question always, always comes up as to whether someone can get up and speak because they are afraid they might lose it? Which, to be clear, generally means cry. Lose their ability to speak easily or otherwise show what they are going through. We may not be a society that hires professional mourners who can really lift up the spirit of the thing. But why should we always be so concerned that we not lose it in public? Or maybe even in private? What would be so terrible? What would we think if we were in the congregation, or when we have been in the congregation, and saw someone go up to speak and struggle to get through what they wanted to say? Or even fail to complete what they wanted to say. I have seen that. I have seen that. And what I thought was something like this. That is a brave person. This is such a hard thing to do. They are in pain, and I am in pain. And part of my pain is with them. What in that is not what we would want? Gender stereotypes and stiff upper lipping it aside, what a relief it must be to express your grief that way. When the funeral director tore my ribbon, and I learned why, I thought, one day if I am ever that grieved, I will go ahead and tear my clothes and wear them torn. This contained, formal, clean little symbol only points to what should be, what we should feel free to do which is not about small, tasteful, elegant references to agony. I have no universal prescription for going through grief and mourning and living after the death of one we have loved. Each of us walks our own path, and my way is not yours, and yours is not another's, and on some parts of our paths we meet, and on others we diverge. But whatever the details of our journeys of grief and loss, of healing, and of what never goes away, remembering and how we remember are crucial. There was a This I Believe segment on National Public Radio where someone spoke about their commitment to remembering well as almost an antidote to death. Death is a form of oblivion, and that is its greatest injustice. For all the attention we pay to these vessels, our bodies, what matters most is our souls. That a living soul full of such passion and fear and longing and courage and beauty and love should disappear in every sense from this realm of existence. However much we care, however much we have left to give, however cruelly or young or unready we may die, is literally incomprehensible. And yet it is true, and it is inescapable, even for the most famous, even for the wisest. This oblivion is the root of much in religion to all of us left behind, over and over again, and so full ourselves of those precious intangibles which now include memories of the one disappeared. It is impossible to understand or to reconcile ourselves. We may accept it because it is clearly the brute way of this world, but we cannot understand it. We have few choices regarding any of this, but one broad, benevolent, healing choice that is available to us all who love and are bereft is to remember. Even when what we carry is not only love and loss, but also conflicts and resentments and hurt and injury, remembering is important. We don't need to sterilize our memories. They ought to be real. And we may not have our loved ones there to work out painful issues with, but we can work on ourselves to make peace with what we know and what we remember. This can be true even for someone who caused us more pain than joy, who hurt us more than they helped us. And it is surely true for those who mainly helped us and loved us back the best they could. Memory books, photo albums, annual trips to the graveyard, visits to a special place, taking a breath to remember them when a certain song comes on, almost anything can be a ritual of remembrance. Whatever form that remembering takes, it works against the obliterating power of death. To a point. There is no way we can truly hold the loved one with us still. As Joan Didion writes at the end of her book about her year after her husband died suddenly and unexpectedly, the year of magical thinking, she said, "I realize as I write this that I do not want to finish this account. I know why we try to keep the dead alive. We try to keep them alive in order to keep them with us. I also know that if we are to live ourselves, there comes a point at which we must relinquish the dead. Let them go. Keep them dead. Let them become the photograph on the table." To all this, the only other thing I would add is make the most of your time with those you love. Try to have as few regrets as possible. I cannot stress that enough. In this world that keeps us busy and asks so much of us, make the most of your time with those you love and try to have as few regrets as possible. It is a simple recommendation, but as many of us know, that does not make it an easy one. At most of the memorial services I do, I close with these words. We recommit ourselves to our lives and our work, to the tragedy and miracle of love, to the imperatives and grace of life. It is so often part of my conclusion because it is the most we have. At times this feels inadequate to our longings, and still it is no small thing to attempt. It is an act of courage. Live, love, mourn, remember, repeat. It is a simple, sobering, noble litany. We do it over and over again for those who grace our lives and leave us. And we can only hope that when our turn comes, others will do it for us. Amen.